Good morning and welcome to Good Design. Good to see you all and thanks for coming along. We have some interesting things to learn about in the design sphere this morning. I just wanted to start by showing you a couple of pictures or a few photos, so we might just bring them up if we may. Lucas, who can tell what this is? That's 30 years ago when Big Camp was opened. Big Camp was opened in October 1992, 30 years ago. These are pictures from the opening ceremony at that time. We can go to the next one. The plaque's still there. You might notice the roundabout looks a little bit different now. Have a look at the next one. There's the official opening with the Mayor of Kempsey, Pastor X Moe, and Floyd Panola, who was GenSec equivalent at the time. And I think there's one more. Anyway, just thought it was vaguely interesting. That's 30 years ago. And, you know, I think we can be grateful for the vision there. You know, 30 years ago, people had to say, we would like a camp space. What do we do? Where should we have it? These are big decisions. I mean, it's $500,000 decision then to open this place. And I think it's over that 30 years, it's proved to be a pretty good design. It's been a pretty successful camp. It's been a good space to use. It's been a success. The negatives are still there, perhaps. There's still challenges. This year it's been disease. Who knows someone that's already gone home because of COVID? A lot, yeah. Obviously, hot water is still a challenge 30 years on. I just want a hot shower. Turns out that's hard. There's still other challenges, like people with noisy cars at 5 a.m. So there's things to work on, and there's things for the future. You know, I think hopefully this week at Connection, you've enjoyed the design of a lot more women speakers, a lot more, and top shelf women speaking, both in their area of expertise with something like this setting, and women preachers, you know, bringing it. Hopefully you've enjoyed. I'm sure the music looked a little different 30 years ago to what it did. Things like this set design, you can imagine 30 years ago there was a pulpit, there was just the big tent. There's still challenges. You know, this was the first year in seven that we've had coloured lighting. Coloured lighting is a thing. There's still tents in this camp that don't use coloured lighting because they think that's an issue. Caffeine is another issue. There's things that, you know, maybe they're important, maybe they're not. If you've got thoughts on any of those things, you know, they're things that you can give feedback on. The design of camp is just an interesting topic. Danielle Holliday Toomey, who's the camp manager, caretaker, thanks, that's a good word. She was going to present on that this week, but she's got COVID, so she didn't get to speak to some of those topics. But, you know, it's interesting, and you're allowed to talk about it. You're allowed to think about that. You're allowed to give feedback on where camp is and where you want it to be. You're allowed to critique. You're allowed to compliment. Feel free to do that. That's a good thing. Yeah, that might do. Let's introduce our first speaker. Thank you, Aaliyah.
Okay, so our first speaker is Bruce Hoffer, and we have the privilege to have someone with a wealth of knowledge in genetic counselling. I've known Bruce for a while, done Pathfinders with him. He's one of the amazing leaders. He's just someone who's so encouraging, and I can see how that his attitude and his persona would really speak into his career of genetic counselling. So can we please invite Bruce up to share?
All right, thank you people for coming. So let's do first click. Yes, so today we're going to be talking about design. Genetics, that's what I do. I've been the genetic counsellor in the foster taree area now for 25 years. So genetics is a bit of a moving space, and for those who are remotely interested, I start off with a science degree is how I moved into this space, because most people have never heard of a genetic counsellor. And when we're talking about genetics and genetic counselling and implications for family, it's always important to remember that what's right for one family or one family member might be really, really wrong for another family or another family member. And everyone reacts differently. And just to acknowledge that I work on both Burrupi and Warramai lands, and I pay respect to both elders past, present and future. This lady here had a daughter who has a chromosomal condition. She's from New Zealand, and she's made a book. This clicker doesn't seem to work. Called the Superpower Baby Project, and she went through a number of families in New Zealand who had children with chromosomal conditions and wanted to tell their story of all the superpowers that they have. What's the really special thing that their child has? And it's a fantastic book to have a look through. End of last year, there's been a report that was got sent up to the federal government in regards to genetics and genetic implications and how we all work as a genetics team. And that's not a bad summary of how we work. It's a tad hard to follow, but when you actually look at it, that's how complicated it kind of can be. I thought to put this in context, we'll talk about a referral that I got from an oncologist a couple of months back, and we'll call him James. This guy was referred to me as a 74-year-old male. He had bowel cancer and because he'd been bleeding from the bowel for about 4 months. So, you know, he finally then did something about it. Good tip, guys, if you've been bleeding from the bowel for 4 months, to do something about that. So on the tumour, so they had the operation, they get the tumour, and then they drop 4 different coloured stains on it, if you will. Now, all 4 stains are supposed to stick, just like Lego sticks onto those big green plates. So 2 stuck, 2 didn't. Those 2 that didn't are called MLH1 and PMS2, which basically means it's a good indication that we should go ahead and do further gene testing on that person. So when I rung them up and was taking the family history, so I do it by phone because COVID taught us that, you know what, we can do stuff by phone. And also these patients then don't have to come and try to find where your COVID screening lab is, and then try to find your building, and it's all getting very complicated, isn't it? As it turns out, his paternal, so his dad's sister, had died from ovarian cancer, and while I was doing the phone call, his daughter was there, right? And so I said, look, has anyone else had colonoscopies in your family? Nah. Has anyone else had bleeding from the bowel? And then this lady pipes up going, yeah, I've been bleeding from the bowel for 15 years. And you know how sometimes you think, no, I've misheard that because I'm wearing a mask. And can I just clarify? You said you've been bleeding from the bowel for 15 years. Yeah. And what have you done about that? Nothing. You just go, huh? All right. So funny enough, and she's never had a colonoscopy. So I was like, how about you go and get a colonoscopy while we're dealing with everything else? So just to kind of put things in context, we're looking at chromosomes and DNA, and so if you look at the karyotype on the right-hand side, we know that we're literally half our mum and half our dad. You get one chromosome, one from mum, you get one chromosome, one from dad, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Would this person have been assigned what gender at birth? Other than Lucas and Nola. What gender would this person have been assigned at birth? Female, well done, 2X chromosomes. What else do you know about this person? She would have had Down syndrome. If you see that, she has 3 chromosome 21s, which are these ones here, because this clicker doesn't work. So 3 chromosome 21s. So we can go from the chromosomes, and that's as good as we can do up until the 60s. And then from that, we can now get to the chromosome at the top left-hand side. We can unravel that like you would unravel a necklace with beads on it, and we can get down to the DNA helix. And this is where design gets really funky. So in nucleotides, they work in triplets, so in 3. So as you can see at a TAG point there, that's the starting codon. So then the body knows, okay, we're going to replicate from there right through to the stop codon. There's a whole heap of other DNA, about 97%, And at the moment, we don't think it does anything, but I can't think of any other design that has 97% redundancy. So it's bound to do something. We just don't know what that is yet. And so we know that DNA can replicate. It can go to into RNA, which then makes a protein. But if we have a mutation, as you can see by the red explosion, then if there's a wrong nucleotide at that one point, out of the 3.5 billion letters, if there's one in the wrong spot, in a critical spot, that can then mean the translation's incorrect, which means the protein made's incorrect, which means the function doesn't work. And if we look at humans, we know that we have about 98% of our genes are the same as that as chimps. If we look at mice, it's 92%, fruit flies 44%, 26% the same as yeast. We'd like to think we're a bit more intelligent than yeast, so it must be those 97% of we don't know what's going on. And 18% of our genes are also in common with plants. So the design, or whatever it is, whether you believe in evolution or creation, we've got a pretty consistent design happening across all those coding systems. And so what we can do is, with this family, so we got some blood sent off from our patient James. We sent it off to the lab, and no, it's not NOLA, because I thought it was. But as you can see, they put it through the mass spectrometer, and each of the letters comes up with a colour. So you can see G is red, so there's a spike on red, followed by another spike on G, followed by a spike on G. So guanine, guanine, cytosine, adenine, guamine, guamine. The reference is another guanine should be there. With this patient, there's a thymine there, which means that we have a mutation in this gene, we'll call it the MLH1 gene, and then all of a sudden, that's the mutation that's led to James having bowel cancer and a condition called Lynch syndrome. That one point. Now, the other thing that we know is that that's now going to stay consistent for the whole family. Lynch syndrome is what we call dominantly inherited, which means that because we've identified it with him, he would have inherited it, most likely, for one of his two parents, or he now has a 50-50 chance of passing that on to each of his children, independent of sex. Okay, this is not a boy's thing, it's not a girl's thing. It's just like the breast cancer genes, BRCA1, BRCA2. They're not a boy thing, not a girl thing. Most people somehow get that a little bit mixed up. So we now know that James is an affected father. He has a mutation in the MLH1 gene. Because he has one functioning chromosome and one that with the mutation, 50-50 chance of passing that on to each of his children, independent of sex. If you don't inherit that gene, what does that mean? It means you're back down to population risk for bowel cancer. Is that zero? No, it's down to about that 7-8% chance for that happening. And the best way I've got to be, because lots of people don't get that, so it's like, okay, so I don't have the gene. Does that mean my kids are still at risk? It's like, what did I do wrong in explaining that? So the best analogy I've got is, if you don't have $1 million, can you pass that on to your kids? You kind of can't. So that's how this is inherited. So coming back to our friend James, who must like Bond movies and genetics, and for those of you who have seen the latest Bond movie in genetics, that's a bit interesting. All right, so here's a mutation in the MLH1 gene, and what do we know from that by looking at big international studies? Well, what we know is that 50% of men have a chance of developing bowel cancer. Okay, so it's not an absolute risk, but it's just truckloads higher than population risk. And women are at 45% chance for bowel cancer. So what these people will be doing is having a colonoscopy 12 monthly, okay, and just following that through and actioning as per the surgeon sees. Women have a 35% chance of endometrial cancer and a 10% chance of ovarian cancer. So you can see how that paternal aunt raised that little thing in my head. It's like, aha, hang on, we've got two things here. And his daughter bleeding from the bowel for 15 years was a bit of a giveaway. What can we do about ovarian cancer screening? Absolutely nothing. We've got no good tool yet for ovarian screening or endometrial screening. So what we would be doing is we'd be referring these women through to our gynaeoncs down in Newcastle, and they are the surgeons who would be talking to them in regards to screening. There is none. So the recommendations would be to have a complete hysterectomy at the age of about 45-ish type thing. So once you're well and truly past having your children, and not a case of, oops, hang on, I've now met the man of my dreams or woman of my dreams and pregnancy planning type things. We're past all those windows. And now that's the only screening recommendations we've got. There's also people who are at 7% chance of bladder cancer and of stomach cancer. And again, we've got no decent screening for any of those yet. People are trying hard, obviously, because there'll be big money in it, whoever can get a screening tool to market. All right, so in genetic counselling, you know how every profession has its tool of choice. So for us, it's the family tree. Give me the family tree and I'll remember the story. I can remember the story 15 years ago. I've got a family tree that goes over 16 pages, A4. I've been following this family since 1998. They're a BRCA2 family. If you come to me in the Manning Valley area and you've got a couple of key surnames, I know where you fit in. All right, so here's Mr. James. He's referred to us with bowel cancer. So our quadrants, just in case you needed to know. So first quadrant, so the top right-hand corner would be breast cancer. Second quadrant would be ovarian or prostate, as you can see, his paternal aunt. And then the third quadrant is bowel cancer, and fourth quadrant is cancer other, and then you specify what it is. So our friend James, now that we know that he has a mutation in the bowel cancer gene, we can now offer testing to all four of his kids. Okay? As it turns out, the lady who'd been bleeding from the bowel for 15 years, she did have the MLH1 gene mutation as well. Which means then, so she's in her 50s, which means that we can now offer testing to these, her two kids, daughter and son, who are now in their mid to higher 20s. All right, what are some good things about knowing whether you're gene positive or not? Can you think of any good points? Can do something about it, increased awareness. Yep, do something. Any downsides you can see? Anxiety, yep. People are usually more anxious about not knowing rather than knowing. But anything else? We do have insurance implications. So, funny enough, insurance companies aren't so keen on knowing a person is gene positive. There is a moratorium on at the moment that insurance companies won't be using genetic results for risk profiling. But basically what they'll do is they'll cover you up to $500,000 without too many questions. But after $500,000, they're going to want to know more details. Insurance companies aren't a charity. They're here to make money. It's a complicated space. So we could offer testing to them. And if they were gene positive, then we'd start annual colonoscopies from the mid-20s. So that's what we would do for that family. But as you can see through, it's because we know that he had the gene change, he would have inherited it from one of his two parents. His dad died from a heart condition. Could have had bowel cancer too, but died of a heart condition. So we're going to guess it came from the dad's side, but no firm evidence until we get someone else in that family's side for family history. But as you can see, we have people who are gene positive and gene negative. You can see how this person is either gene negative or has not been tested. But if they were negative, you can see how none of their children are affected. This person is affected and deceased. This person either hasn't been tested or has. She has had gene testing. She's positive and she's now passed it on to two of her kids, and they could then pass it on to their children. Most people don't opt for prenatal diagnosis with bowel cancer genes. I've had a couple of families go through gene testing for some breast cancer families, went through IVF. All right, so that's bowel cancer. I thought I'd jump quickly to recessive inheritance. Recessive inheritance is where you need a mutation on both copies of your gene, a copy from mum and a copy from dad. And so there's the classical, where it's not on my side of the family, it must be on his side of the family, especially if they're separated and no longer together. There's lots of that blame stuff going on. But it's not, it's come down multiple generations. That's where people get quite offended of going, is there any chance that you're related to your partner? You're just fishing for these kind of things. Again, as I said, you need a mutation on both copies of the same gene. And as part of that, one of the conditions is called retinitis pigmentosa, only for those optometrists who are in the house. We're getting lots of referrals currently from Safe Sight Industry Institute down in Sydney from Professor Griggs. There's now gene therapy that's happening in the marketplace for people with a couple of specific conditions, mainly retinitis pigmentosa, if they have known mutations in a couple of really specific genes. So it turns out we haven't hit a mutation yet in any of the genes that I've screened my family members for, which is actually really devastating for them because they're losing sight, as you can see, and it's progressive. And as they're losing sight, they want to know, can I get onto this gene program? And if we can't find the mutations, then no, they can't. I've also got another patient who's pregnancy planning. She has retinitis pigmentosa and she wants to know, can we test her partner to see whether they're a carrier or not, because that would tell the risk of what of their having a child together with RP. We also do truckloads of X-linked conditions like Fragile X. Another big one is Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is a muscular wasting condition, mainly affects boys. And you can see it can affect multiple family members and over a wide, wide period of generations in this case here. So genetics can get a bit complicated at times and just explaining things through. We've come a long way. We've got a very much longer way to go, but that's where we sit at this point in time. If anyone's got any queries, questions or thoughts, genetics.edu.au is a great spot to go. If you've got concerns about anything, talk to your GP about getting a referral through to one of us. We do have horrendous waiting lists in Department of Health. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you for that, Bruce. That was really interesting. A bit of biology for your morning. Our next speaker is Camilla Scaff, and yeah, she's in the area of health ministries. She's doing a great job in Newcastle, rep the Newcastle. They have the food pharmacy, great food, good for you. And yeah, she's just doing heaps of work and speaking into that space, even helping schools with their canteens to have good, nutritious food. So I'd like to welcome Camilla to share with us.
Thank you. Good morning. Okay, so I'm definitely not going to be speaking on such smart things. I just felt like, wow, I can barely follow that. It's very interesting stuff. Thank you. I want to talk about something that I'm passionate about. I'm more of a generalistic. I'm not really expert in anything other than that I'm interested in a lot of different things. And I constantly look for new learning gigs. Like, I like to learn things. And one of my favorite passions is about food. I mean, you like food, right? Everyone likes food. I brought here some fruits for you to look at, because when I think of design, I feel like the foods that we have are basically one of my favorites. So sometimes, like, my husband likes birds, and I like to watch birds to kind of have some fashion ideas. But when I look at the fruits, I also get a lot of nice ideas. I'm very aesthetic. Like, I like to look at things. I like to look at beautiful things. If I come to a place and it doesn't really look good to me, it gives me anxiety, like, truly. And I just have to leave or fix it. Like, I just have a hard time. Those are my bad genes, by the way, because it drives me crazy. But so I like to look at beautiful things. Beauty attracts me. And so everything I do, I'm actually not the best creative, but I like to bring creatives around me because I like to look at things that inspires me. So this is actually one of my favorite fruits. I don't know if you can look because a bit far. Who can guess what fruit? It's just a half of it. So you're looking at the inside. It is a guava. That's right. Good job, Bruce. It's a guava. And as we were talking about genetics, right, when you look at these fruits, I didn't cut my pineapple because I don't want to eat it now. So I also brought another fruit here, just an apple. But I want you to look at inside as well. Each food that gets produced in a tree gets a different design. But it's not only the design that attracts me, the colors, right, the shapes, and the taste. Each thing will taste different. I don't know about you, like my favorite fruit is mangosteen. Who likes mangosteen? You love mangosteen? One of my dream times that I had when I was pregnant of my first child, Katarina, she's 4 and a half now, we went to a mission trip in Cambodia. And I remember going to this fruit stand on the street and they had piles of mangosteen. And back in my country, in Brazil, where I came from, each mangosteen would cost $9 for you to eat. And if you know mangosteen, one doesn't cut it, right? You need to have many. And so $9 for one mangosteen. I remember getting a box of nine once, and it was like $100 for a little box. And that was my treat. Like, it was like, I don't know if it was my birthday or something. I just felt like I deserve this. And then I remember eating the first one, great. The second one, not so great. Third one, and I was like, I wanted to cry because that's not fair. And so I feel like mangosteen, I wish I would have one here to show you. It, to me, looks beautiful, but it also tastes like heaven. It just tastes so good. And so I love to explore and get to know different fruits. And that one of my favorite things is going around the world, visiting different cultures, different diversities, and try fruits. I actually like to keep a little bit of a list. Do you have, I don't know if you have lists of fruits that you've tried before, but I kind of lost track of it, but I feel like I've been well over 200. And going to different countries, I mean, in Brazil, you go north and, you know, south, and you already got over 100, easy. But it's just amazing to see the design and the detail and the thought into each fruit or each veggie or each food. And to know that if you're coming to our afternoon workshop here about gut health, to know that your body needs it. There's a need for that diversity, and there's a reason why we've got it. And the interesting thing is, like, not every space or not every country will have all the same fruits and veggies. But wherever you go, you're going to get the veggie that is rich in vitamin C, or the one it's with antioxidants. And you can find the rainbow in every single, readily available foods everywhere you go in the world. And I find that fascinating, because you don't need to have access to global fruits. If you can, that's more fun, isn't it? You get to try different things. But your body just needs what you have around you. So anyway, this is just an introduction to one of the topics that has been a big interest to me lately, and it's called syntropic farming. Have you heard of syntropic farming before? No? Well, Ash, I think you would have heard this week at least, because you're coming to our workshops. So we have had a group meeting at 7 a.m. just to experience a little bit of this. It was something crazy. I just had put last minute. So sorry for those that didn't see. It was not available in the booklet. We just kind of spread around the toilet some posters. But why is it interesting to me is because I'm not a farmer. I'm actually not, I've grown some things in my life, but I'm, you know, mostly I killed things than grown things, to be honest. But what I love about the theme of syntropic farming, and I learned it recently, is that you don't need to be an expert. You just need to be curious, and you need to, and you can learn. The other thing that I love about syntropic farming or gardening is that you can just do it on your small patch. You can have an apartment and just have a little vase and actually try to explore it, because it's really the concept of having a forest that gives you food. The other thing I love about this concept is that it produces food or whatever you do in abundance. So besides the fact that you allow nature to do its work and you don't need to work too hard, I love to share, especially when it comes to food. And I know my friend here, Carolina, likes to share too, because I have been to her house and she makes amazing food. And there are always heaps of people in her house eating food. So I love the concept of being able to share. And this style of planting a garden or farming not only allows me to have fresh foods, but it allows me to share with other people as well. So I wanted to share a little video with you. It's actually about 7 minutes. It's the video by the guy who started this concept. He's a Swiss guy. He's been living in Brazil for over 50 years, and he's my friend's neighbor. And he's now being known around all the world because of the climate changes. They're trying to find better ways of doing farming, eco-forest and all of that. And so I feel privileged to have access to this and to have found him and his concept. And I'm passionate about sharing about it. So I just felt like, because I'm curious about it, I wanted to share a little bit with you about that design. And that ties us into, what really God created us.
Será que não seria mais inteligente de criarmos agroecossistemas em que a planta se sente bem e nos concentrar só por o nosso trabalho que cabe a gente? Sim, faz parte do meu trajeto desde cedo, sempre estudando, olhando o funcionamento, sempre comparando como que a natureza faz e pois mais confiança na natureza do que nos nossos conceitos. Nós somos parte de sistema inteligente e não os inteligentes. E na medida que eu vi que faz sentido, ou seja, que faz sentido, resultados muito bons, pedi demissão do meu cargo e comecei a trabalhar. Primeiro na Europa, com ecossistema lá. Depois, na fim da década 70, em Costa Rica, e desde o início da década 80, aqui nesse país. A agricultura sintrópica é uma forma de produzir usando os princípios desenvolvidos pela própria natureza. Aqui você está vendo, esse é o que eu cortei nesse momento. E depois tem o material de outro serviço, seja que foi feito há uns poucos meses atrás. Tem uns que são mais rápidos, por exemplo, aqui as folhas. Então você tem aqui uma madeira também, já um pouquinho mais velha. Você vê o solo preto, criado pelo trabalho de 34 anos de cultivo, colhendo o tempo todo, sem trazer adubo de fora, sem trazer calcário, sem nada, só o manejo do ecossistema. Com isso, eu reciclo por ano aproximadamente 180 a 200 toneladas de matéria verde por hectare, que corresponde a uns aproximadamente 15 a 20 toneladas, 15 a 20 quilos de matéria seca. A agrofloresta permite de você usar adubos trazidos de fora, de você usar algum agrotóxico. Eu, no meu caso, não uso nada. O maior insumo que eu uso para a minha forma de agricultura é o saber. Veja, 84, quando comprei esse lugar, foi no mapa, nas fotografias feitas pela Ivama, foi o lugar mais fraco da grande região. 10 anos depois, eu tive uma visita por parte de funcionários da Ivama, me perguntando o que está fazendo, o que estou fazendo, que tá, cada ano está aumentando o índice. Naquele tempo era 7,8, sendo que 1 é terra arada e 10 é floresta de galeria ou de mata ciliar de florestas úmidas. Comecei a trabalhar, usei em primeiro lugar mandioca, era a ferramenta mais importante, junto com abacaxi, mas o que realmente dá é o motor no início, quem pode crescer no início é mandioca, e usei muitas árvores. Plantei aproximadamente 7 a 10 sementes por metro quadrado de diferentes árvores. O meu sistema, seja essa a minha forma de agricultura, é uma agricultura de processos. Faço agroecossistema parecido na sua dinâmica, no seu funcionamento, ao ecossistema natural e original do local. Eu uso processos de vida para disponibilizar nutrientes. Nesse solo aqui era considerado solo pobre, não recomendado para plantar cacau. 30 anos depois, faz uma análise e o solo tem um pH dos melhores solos da zona cacaueira da Bahia, apesar do fato que nunca uso nada. Ele vai criar plantas vigorosas que não necessitam de adubo. Cada 3, 4 semanas a gente colhe cacau. E depois fermenta, seca e transforma. Seja, a gente faz, leva ela até o conchando e a gente usa ela como bebida e vende ela para bebida sem açúcar. Mas sempre, beneficia até o final. Além de tudo, no meio do caminho, a gente pode usar ele para chupar o cacau. É um maravilhoso fruto. Veja, eu não sou missionário. De forma nenhuma. Eu faço esse trabalho com plantas por gosto, sempre por gosto, desde pequeno. As plantas não mentem, não fingem. Os animais não mentem, não fingem. O ser humano, sim. O ser humano é a única espécie que gasta dinheiro para matar os irmãos da espécie dele. As relações intra-específicas na natureza são todas elas são baseadas unilateralmente no amor incondicional e na cooperação. O que posso fazer para ser querido, para ser útil dentro do sistema? Como que vou cultivar os meus cultivos para que não tenha necessidade de ação? Contração contra ele, a partir do sistema imunológico, vai ficar mais barato, ele vai produzir mais. Os princípios são da natureza. Eles podem ser aplicados tanto com as poucas plantas que você tem na sua veranda, quanto em grande escala, porque as leis são os mesmos. A nossa atual forma é buscar os inimigos, seja, em vez de buscar o problema dentro de nós, estamos buscando o outro. Todas as civilizações que tivemos, já são centenas de civilizações, todas elas, mesmo destino. Mesmo destino, mesmo erro, cometido o mesmo erro. Afastar a floresta para o nosso mau comportamento não é o fim da vida no planeta, mas pode ser o fim da nossa espécie, do nosso planeta. É uma questão de atitude, é uma questão de querer e de entender. Não tem escape. A gente só para poder produzir para o futuro, para todas as pessoas e dignamente, usando os princípios que a própria natureza desenvolveu.
So that was just a little bit of an introduction to syntropic farming. If you've never heard of it, one of the things that drove me to be curious about it is because, as was mentioned here before, we just opened Food Pharmacy a few months ago. And as a plant-based chef, when I was starting cooking, because we were still looking for a chef, and I was working full-time there cooking the food, I realized that a lot of the things that we bought they would come not as great. It's like, you know, you buy the veggies, the fruits, or the whole produce, and even because we're a whole food plant-based shop, we would receive things that were not optimal. And they started getting frustrated about it, especially through COVID. It was, you would order two boxes, you would get half a box of things. And so I started thinking, what can we do? And so this is why I'm passionate about this idea of producing your own food. And because it could be good for us and could be good for others. But I'm not even that. I think that's just a product of the process, really, getting the food. I think it's fun to learn new ways and to learn about nature and to learn how we... And I love... Gosht is actually not a believer. Like, he doesn't believe in the things that we believe. But he has come in touch with nature, and he's learned that we need to really reconsider our attitude towards nature. And I love that the process, when you get trained by him and his disciples, is that you've got to treat the trees and you've got to treat what you plant when you're planting a seed with care, because it does make a difference. My mother did a course with him, and she was then later on planting, and she hired a guy who had been planting cassava for 20 years. And he was upset at her because she was telling him that the eye of the seed was upside down when he was planting. And he's like, I've been doing this for 20 years. You want to know more than me? She's like, I learned this. I'm going to do one day and you do your way. And his cassava was half size of hers. And her cassava was twice as big as his. And he learned it. So there are lots of things that we can learn to do better. And I like challenges. And then I thought, well, I'm not really a farmer, but I'm into challenges. So if you ever have a chance to come and visit us in Newcastle, we started doing a garden. So we're actually putting a garden in our car park. And we're starting a garden behind where there's a little forest. It's, we're trying to appeal to the council that we can use the land to do a little community garden. And who knows where we're going to end up. But yeah, we'd love to get you inspired if you want to check more. There are some videos. This concept is actually growing in Australia. I know Australia is being big in permaculture. I would say this is pretty much the evolution of permaculture. It just embraces more concepts. It's really based on the processes and how you do it, and that makes a whole heap of difference. And we have a lot of farmers in Australia now who's getting council, actually paying heaps of money for people like him to come and teach them. And I had the privilege of having a volunteer coming and work with me this year. He just finished medical school. You might have heard or met him around. His name is Jabez. And that's why I decided last minute to start a little experience here, because we have a vision for this camp. Lloyd was talking about the camp 30 years ago. So I hope, Lloyd, that in 30 years from now, all of the camp is a food forest that can not only be sustainable to the camp, to all around, but it can be a source of income as well as a source of food to all of us. And I know this is possible using this method. I love a challenge. I was told 5 years ago when I want to start this here that the soil here is no good. Well, just watch out. Next year when you come, we're going to prove you wrong. Not you, but whoever thinks this soil no good. It's a sandy soil. There's such a thing. Actually, Ellen White says this. There's nothing like a bad soil. It's just a soil that has not been worked properly. And that's what Gosht says as well. And he found for himself. And as you could see, he was able to do all this beautiful cacao. His cacao in Brazil and the people that he taught are one of the best grades organic cacao. So if you ever come across some organic Brazilian cacao or chocolate, check it out. Thank you.
Who knows what this is? Hands up if you know what this is. Hands up if your education was heavily dependent on this technology. Hands up if your education in no way encountered this technology at any stage. This is the overhead projector. It's a miracle of simple design, an incredibly bright light, a condensing lens, and some focusing onto the screen. Endless hours of people adjusting and trying to get it into the right position. Hopefully you all remember those moments of your teacher trying to do the reveal one word at a time. Some of you will remember that this is how we did worship. This is how we worshipped. My dad was always horrified at the off-the-wall songs that we'd have to sing, songs that weren't from the hymn book. You knew that there would be apostasy right there as soon as they were projected using the overhead projector. This one is... I'll just show you very briefly. Here's just a little... So in here there's a lens. This is called a condensing lens, which I didn't know at the time. This one's doing pretty well for, I guess, 40 years old, I suppose. This is a condensing lens in here. It's like a focusing lens. Now, what's delightful about this lens is that, say, just imagine a scenario where you're in a classroom, the teacher's running a little late. Nothing could go wrong in this situation. It turns out these lenses work very differently when they're upside down, but it turns out they're visually indistinguishable. So say, like, you know, you might have just been in class, you might have been a difficult teenager, and you flip this lens around, the teacher would come in, try to present their material, and instead of that lovely keystone, you know how it always looks like a keystone when you project from an overhead projector? It would just be this tight, small circle that you couldn't focus, and the class was ruined for the day. I don't know how I know that. That's just some random information that's not related to anything. It was only many years later I discovered about that. And it's not working because it's got to have the bits in it. I just wanted to shout out the overhead projector because this is possibly the last time you will ever see one in your lives. I think the overhead projector is done. It's been superseded by the data projector, and of course, thank goodness, we can now do much more apostasy type music on the much more high resolution screens. So thank you, data. Thank you, overhead projector. Thank you for your service, and goodbye to you forever. Our final speaker is someone that you must follow on Facebook if you use that abomination. This particular pastor always has a beautiful soapbox moment, and he tells a beautiful... he always gives great examples of how we need to think about keeping our children in church, what we need to do with that young person window, that if you want children involved in church, what you need to do. He's very worth a follow. He's been our children's ministry director for many years in this conference, and he's a fascinating speaker who continues to work in chaplaincy. Unfortunately, he's also unwell, so he's not here. He's been in hospital and with infections and problems, so he's not here. So I get to say my favourite ever words from school. Early Mark, thanks for coming today, and we'll be back tomorrow at 9:40. We'll have Lindell Peterson and Quinton Betteridge, and they'll be talking about some interesting design topics as well. So please come along for 9:40 for our last one tomorrow. Thank you all.